morning. We're delighted this morning to welcome Hamilton High School, who are with us on the national award-winning Courtless Class program. Will the students from Hamilton High please stand so you can see it? Well, welcome. Won't you be seated, please? And we have students also from Horned Middle School of Waukesha who have joined us today also at the Courtless Class. Would they please stand? Oh, welcome to you all. Will you please be seated? Now that we have met you, I'd like you all to meet us. So I'd like to introduce the bench to you. On my far right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice William Babbage. And to his left, Justice Jeanine Geske. And to her left, Justice Patrick Crooks. And the students will meet with Justice Geske and myself at noon for a discussion of the court's procedure. With that said, we'll move on to our first case. If counsel are ready, and if we would take their seats at counsel table, please. Case is 97-0970, Clark versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Representing American Family is David.
Good morning. May it please the court, David Plyner appearing on behalf of defendant appellant American Family Mutual Insurance Company. Brief background of this case, the appellees, the Clarks, sued uninsured motorist coverage under three auto policies issued by American Family and one umbrella policy issued by Cincinnati Insurance to Barnes Clark, father of Bradley Clark. Bradley was injured in an accident with an uninsured motorist in Greece in 1991. American Family subsequently moved for summary judgment on three issues which are before the court today. The trial court denied American Family's motion in all respects. The trial court held first that a territorial restriction clause in American Family's policies, which limited coverage for all types of coverage to accidents occurring in the United States and Canada, was unenforceable in the UM context. The court also held that a policy provision requiring the insureds to join the uninsured driver to the suit was unenforceable. And finally, the court held that the question of whether Bradley was living with his father and living in his father's household at the time of the accident, which was a prerequisite to coverage, was a factual issue. That issue was then tried, and the court determined based on the facts that Bradley was living with his parents and was therefore covered insured. Cincinnati thereafter settled its claim for $60,000. After trial on the merits of the case, judgment was entered in favor of the Clarks for approximately $315,000. On motions after verdict, American Family renewed the three issues referenced before and also requested a credit for the $60,000 payment from Cincinnati. The trial court denied those motions. American Family appealed to District 4. District 4 Court of Appeals issued an order certifying the territorial restriction issue to this court. And by order of November 20th, this court accepted all issues for review. I will, with that, move to the issue of the territorial restriction clause and whether it is enforceable in the context of UM coverage. There's no dispute that this clause is enforceable in the context of liability coverage. I believe the issue boils down to whether there are legitimate policy reasons unique to territorial restriction clauses which would justify treating UM coverage like liability coverage in this particular instance. American Family submits that there are good reasons because territorial restriction clauses address similar problems in both liability coverage and UM coverage.
Counsel, an argument is made by your opposing counsel that you're right. There's no dispute that this territorial limitation is applicable in liability coverage consistent with the statute 344.33(2). And that statute evinces the policy and the intent of a legislature that in liability policies, a territorial restriction is allowed. That there is no, your opposing counsel indicates, there is no statute with regard to uninsured motor vehicle coverage. And therefore, that also evinces, that omission evinces an intent of the legislature vis-a-vis public policy. How do you respond to that?
First of all, I read the statute of questions requiring liability coverage at a minimum in the United States and Canada. And it has been interpreted from that that restrictions on liability coverage outside of those areas is acceptable. I don't view, in this instance, the legislature's failure to address the question of territorial restrictions in the UM context as being a direct indication the legislature did not intend for those restrictions to apply. I think that's something that they simply chose not to address via statute and left it up to the courts to rule on.
Well, but isn't insurance, especially uninsured motorist insurance, most useful out of the country? Inside the country, a lot of states require insurance. Wisconsin doesn't, but if you've had an accident and you have not been able, and you're not insured, haven't paid your judgment, you might be required to. So uninsured motorist is extremely helpful for someone traveling abroad where insurance may not be as prevalent. And how else can you protect yourself if you don't get coverage through uninsured motorist? So why shouldn't we say, look, the legislature didn't stop you or didn't say that anything about your foreign travel, nor the coverage?
There's no question, I think, that from the insurer's perspective, both uninsured motorist coverage and liability coverage, for that matter, are very important everywhere and very important outside.
Yeah, but if you were going to drive a car outside the country, you can protect yourself by buying liability coverage when you rent the car or buy the car outside. But I don't know that you can cover yourself against someone else's liability that easily.
I don't know that either, and I think looking at it solely from the insured's perspective, those concerns are certainly valid. I think in the context of this issue, though, the countervailing concerns of the insurer are rather unique and need to be considered as well, and it is my opinion outweigh the concerns from the insured's perspective. I would reference those various cases which have found that such restrictions are valid in the UM context.
What are the countervailing arguments that you just referred to?
The countervailing arguments as discussed in these cases is the fact that it is a virtual impossibility for insurance companies to assess the risk of uninsured motorist coverage in other countries because there is no practical way for them to determine statistically the number of uninsured motorists in every country in the globe. It would require...
Can you do that in the United States?
I believe that companies assess the risk based on statistical determinations in the United States.
No, but you always have the maximum coverage, the maximum that the insurance company can be out. So if you sell a policy for $50,000, you know, maximum you're going to be out is $50. It's not like you're going to be out $2 million. So you can estimate your coverage. And my understanding is that the only kinds of insurance we have really good estimates and really good statistics is life insurance. That's really with the actuarial tables.
It's
otherwise,
true.
It's a crapshoot with auto accident.
It's true that you can limit your potential exposure on any given claim to the minimum required by statute. but I think the concern that's expressed in some of these cases, and I think it's a valid one, is that the insurance laws, the economy, the various risks in all the other countries around the globe make it uniquely impossible for insurance companies to have any way of determining what the potential risk is. Really in any type of coverage, but that includes uninsured motorists.
Does the Department of State keep statistics of injured Americans abroad in auto accidents?
It may do that, I don't know.
Right, then you can figure out the number of Americans that are going to be abroad, because they keep statistics on how many travel abroad. In fact, they keep statistics on how many travel to which countries. They can do that through the passport control. Seems to me you can figure out then what your liability might be.
I think the difficulty with that is in any given case, it's impossible to determine where in advance an insured would be traveling and what the risk would be. And I think that the risk can change very rapidly in other countries depending on the economic situation, the political situation. And I think that's the focus that the courts that have upheld the restrictions hone in on when they conclude that this from the insurer's perspective is unique outside of the United States and Canada, and is something that counteracts or counterbalances the concern from the insurer's perspective of having the coverage.
The real issue with statistics that you need to know is how many uninsured motorists there are in any given country.
Yes.
Mr. Pliner, aren't you really asking us to take over the role of the legislature? We've got 632.32. It doesn't say anything at all about territorial limitations, and you're asking us to write those in, are you not?
I don't believe I'm asking the court to rewrite the laws. I think that it's within the court's province to interpret statutes as they exist. There's no prohibition against this type of clause. As I indicated in my briefs, I believe that when the legislature amended the statutes that you just referenced in 1995 regarding reducing clauses, for example, it may have been in response to some earlier decisions which invalidated those clauses in the UM context. To the extent that the court did not address territorial restrictions in those amendments, that issue, I don't feel, was directly in front of the legislature. There was no reason for the legislature to be thinking about that because there were no prior court decisions that addressed that particular issue. Certainly, if there had been a decision that territorial restrictions are unenforceable in the UM context and the legislature did not address that in their amendments, then certainly that holding would still prevail in the court's determination. On that issue would control in the absence of some statement from the legislature.
Well, the other jurisdictions that you've referred to in your brief, are those jurisdictions where the statute was silent also, as it is in this case?
I believe in Minnesota, which I believe is one of the jurisdictions in question, I believe it was, I'm not certain, and I believe that in the Pennsylvania courts, which the police discussed, it was silent as well.
When you say silent, are you referring to silence with regard to both UM coverage and liability coverage?
UM coverage is the only that I'm aware of.
We have here, to follow up Justice Crooks' question, you say you're not asking us to rewrite the law with regard to UM coverage, not to rewrite 632.32. Yet there's something to be said. The legislature knows how to use the words within the United States or the Dominion of Canada because they wrote those words with regard to liability insurance. They didn't write those words with regard to UM coverage. And why should we ostensibly write those words for them?
Well, I believe to the extent that the legislature references UM coverage as being required and not having any comparable language regarding the geographical location, it's reasonable to read that as meaning that the UM coverage is available in the same respect that liability coverage would be available, subject to any restrictions that might be supported either by statute or by public policy. and I think the public policy concerns that I expressed are what are important here.
If I understand the trial court's decision, the trial court said your policy was ambiguous and that it didn't exclude sufficiently out of the country. Is that right?
I don't recall the trial court saying it was ambiguous.
Okay, well, the last line says it should find it's ambiguous, but then I'm not sure it does say it is. But anyway, doesn't this involve an interpretation of the policy?
Well, I think it does, but I think that the territorial restriction clause, by its terms and in the context of the policy, is intended to be universal in the sense it's intended to apply to all coverages.
Well, what do you think the trial court said here?
My understanding of the trial court's ruling was that regardless of the plain language of the policy, territorial restriction clauses were simply unenforceable.
So you think that that's what the trial court said, so we don't have to worry about what the policy said?
No, I think that the trial court's ruling was akin to a ruling that a unambiguous reducing clause, for example, if before the court prior to 1995, would be unenforceable, even though it was unambiguous because of the court's prior rulings.
Because of the court's what?
Prior rulings regarding reducing clauses.
Well, what section is it that allows you to limit your liability to Canada and the United States? Which section of the statute?
344.33 sub 2 references liability coverage, which must be provided within the United States or Canada.
That's 344.33?
Yes, 0.33 sub 2. The statute doesn't speak in terms of a limitation so much as in terms of what is required, but it's been interpreted to permit restriction outside of those areas.
And then there's 632.325H, right?
Yes.
That allows you to limit coverage.
Yes.
And that's what you say you did here. You limited your coverage.
Yes.
Because sub 6 is not available.
Yes, correct. The concerns which I have set forth, I believe, justify enforcing the territorial restriction clause here. The next question, which is an issue raised by the appellees, is whether doing so would be in conflict in any way with current Wisconsin law. We submit that it would not. None of those cases, for example, some of them involving reducing clauses, implicate the unique policy concerns that we believe are present here. The Welch case probably contains the broadest language regarding the scope of UM coverage. It speaks in terms of coverage being available under all circumstances. I believe a fair reading of that case is that it makes that statement in the context of determining where the insured claimant must be vis-a-vis the insured vehicle. And Welch simply says that the insured need not be within the insured vehicle at the time of the accident in order to have UM coverage. They can be anywhere vis-a-vis the insured vehicle. But Welch does not specifically address the unique concerns of territorial restriction clauses. Finally, on that issue, to the extent that this is an issue of first impression, both sides have spoken about trends in the law regarding UM coverage. The Clarks have argued that UM coverage is routinely expanded and that the courts have a history of expanding it when possible and striking down restrictions. I simply note with the legislative changes in 1995, the legislature has indicated that UM coverage is not necessarily available under all circumstances in a universal sense. Insurers can impose certain restrictions on it. And while that statute does not specifically address territorial restriction clauses, I think the implication is that other restrictions which further legitimate public policy concerns may be imposed by insurers.
why isn't the implication just as legitimately that this is not one of the limitations that the legislature deemed appropriate to put on UM coverage? It's not listed in 632 sub 5 or sub 6.
Well, two reasons, I guess. First, because that statute, as I read it, pertains and focuses primarily on reducing clauses and on giving insurers essentially a credit for amounts that the insured has received from other sources.
That's sub 5, but not sub 6.
Well, I think that, as I suggested before, that the fact that the legislature has not specifically addressed that is not as telling as it would be had there been a court decision on that issue earlier, which would have brought that subject into focus and required the court or required the legislature to make a response.
Was there a court decision that occasioned that limitation in the liability coverage when the legislature wrote that limitation into 344.33?
I'm not aware if there was. If there are no further questions on that issue, I'll briefly address the residency issue. There was an initial question by the parties as to the proper standard of review. There's no question there was a trial, and there were a number of lengthy facts brought out, but I think it's fair to say those facts were essentially undisputed. It was essentially a matter of determining whether those undisputed facts fit the legal definition of an insurance household. And I submit that's a question of law rather than an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. The case law recognizes, I think...
Was there any factual dispute? I mean, we've got a lot of facts in the brief about where he was living during the summers and all that. Was there any dispute as to any of those facts?
There was none that I'm aware of.
Was there any dispute with regard to intent? In other words, those facts seem to me to possibly suggest it. From one perspective, American Family argues about the relationship between the son and the mother. And I assume you argue that, suggesting that they didn't get along and the son didn't intend to spend time at home. Your opposing counsel takes a different slant of the facts, doesn't emphasize any discord in the relationship, and emphasizes graduate school. So isn't intent a fact in this case?
The intent was one of the issues that was developed by the facts, but I think that the intent that was clear by Bradley's own testimony was that he intended to return to his family home for a brief period of time. His estimate was it might be a minimum of 3 months. His goal was to find a job or get into a graduate program.
But factually, at that time, he had no other home. I mean, he was traveling abroad and considered this. That's where he kept his things and his furniture.
It's true that he did not have any other permanent abode. I think under the Pamperin case, the fact that there is no other permanent abode does not necessarily mean he's a resident of the household in question. People at this stage of life, I think the case law recognizes, are sort of in a state of flux. They fall somewhere on a spectrum between being totally dependent on their parents or guardians to being totally independent. And the question under the three factors that are recognized in the case law is where any given person falls. We know Bradley was not living under the same roof as his parents, with the exception of 3 weeks prior to his departure on his trip, and he had not been there for a number of months. Regarding the closeness of the relationship, we have never argued that there was any antagonism between Bradley and his parents. But the fact of the matter is he moved out both because his parents and he agreed that he wanted more independent living. He was a free spirit, his mother described him as, and she was not comfortable with some of the choices he was making and the things he was doing.
And you argue that they got in arguments the summer after his, was it junior year or sophomore year?
I believe it started after sophomore year. They had certainly had arguments and disagreements about the choices he was making. That coupled with the intended duration of the relationship, which as I've already indicated, from Bradley's perspective, he expected it to be limited once he returned from Europe. I believe regardless of what standard of review applies, shows that he was not a resident of or he was not living in his parents' household for coverage purposes at the time of the accident. The remaining two issues, whether the insured was required to join.
What was residency during that time?
His residency? Well, by his own testimony, he was living in Europe. However, in his own, he was living in Europe. However, in his own mind, he defined that or interpreted it. And again, I think an insured's common understanding of the terminology is relevant here. And while he didn't have a permanent address and while he had...
So he had no really permanent residence?
He had no permanent residence.
What's your position?
The remaining issues, unless the court has questions, I will stand on my brief regarding the credit for Cincinnati's payment and the obligation to join the moped driver to the suit.
Let me ask you, in regard to the residency issue, where were Clark's books, things of that nature? He had finished college, as I understand it. Were the books stored at his parents' home?
Specifically the books I don't know about. I do know that he had personal effects still at his parents' home in his old room.
And that would include clothing and things of that nature as well?
I believe so, yes.
Now, how did the plaintiff here prove that there was no insurance?
How did the plaintiff prove there was no insurance?
That the driver, the other person, was uninsured.
Yes. I don't recall.
That was an, I would assume, essential part of his case.
Yes, it was.
How you suggest that he should have to sue the person in Greece to determine that?
Well, my argument is simply that under the policy, they're required to join the uninsured driver unless they're unidentified, and I don't know of any evidence that this person could not be identified.
What's the point of joining?
The point of joining would be so that the insurer could preserve the claims back against...
Could you speak up, please?
Sure. The point of joining them would be so that the insurer could preserve any potential claims they have against the tortfeasor.
Well, but here, the insurer could preserve the claim against the tortfeasor. It seems to me, if I recall correctly, about 9 months after the action was commenced, there was the summary judgment. And about a year after the court's determination as to whether or not the tortfeasor should be brought in, and the issue was brought before the trial court. The trial court said, no, you don't need to bring the tortfeasor in, and then a year passed. How can you argue that you needed the opportunity when you had plenty of opportunity?
Our position is that simply under the policy language, the insured was obligated to do that. There's no prejudice requirement in the terms of the policy, per se. Appellees have argued that the Raines case, a recent decision, does not require prejudice by analogy. The court will be hearing that case next month. But it's our position that simply by virtue of the policy language, it was the insured's obligation to do that.
Could they have named this Greek person in a state action here? You'd have to have service, wouldn't you?
Yes.
Wouldn't that have to go to federal court or not?
I would presume it would.
Counsel, thank you. We'll have a few moments for rebuttal. Mr. Riley, you represent Bradley Clark.
Thank you, Justice. Good morning. May it please the court. I might touch just briefly on the last issue that was covered, just sort of for purposes of continuity. From our standpoint, we believe what is critical is a close perusal of the language of the policy, because what that policy says is that you must notify us of an action that's brought to determine liability and damages. I believe that language is fairly read as an action against someone other than the company, because clearly, if the action is to be an action under the UM coverage against the company, there would be no need to notify the company. They're served, they're a party to the action, and they obviously have to know about the action. So to argue that that language should govern an action against the company is simply not logical in view of the entire language of the provision upon which the company lies. I think the second point that is critical there is this, that the same provision also says at the end, without our consent, You know, no judgment will be binding against us. If we adopt the position that the company takes, that would mean that the company could withhold consent for an uninsured motorist action against it, and by doing so, bar any action, if indeed this provision is meant to apply to a UM action against the company. I believe the only fair and rational reading of the provision is that it is not intended to apply to this sort of action, but is intended to apply to an action against the uninsured motorist. What the company's concern is, clearly, is that if there's an action brought against someone else, they want a chance to participate in that so they don't end up with a judgment against them that suddenly they have to have no opportunity to defend upon, and then have their insured come forward and say, now pay us this $1 million judgment we obtained against someone else. That's not a problem in this case, and we don't believe that provision should bar the action here. We would also note the company had ample opportunity to raise that at an earlier stage and did not do so.
Well, how'd you prove that he was uninsured?
It was stipulated, Justice, that it was not disputed by the company. If I may turn quickly to the uninsured motorist issue, the extraterritorial clause, which I think is the pivotal issue in the case, I think there are several things that are important here. One, there is a clear and broad public policy that's been enunciated in this state favoring broad and accessible uninsured motorist coverage. It's based really on twin pillars. The first is the personal and portable language that this court first used in Welch and has used in a number of cases since and is used very consistently. The second is the language which appears in the Nicholson case, which says that the purpose of uninsured motorist coverage is to place the injured party in the same position as if the uninsured motorist were insured.
How would you, since this is a contractual, you agree that this was clearly in the policy, or are we talking about it was ambiguous that there was nothing that restricted the territorial limitations? Because my concern goes to your, I think that it's obvious, that this will be a public policy consideration of this court, and I'm concerned about if insurance is based on actuarial accounting standards and understanding the risk, unless they put a $50,000 limitation that would be worldwide, I am concerned about how you would ever come up with comparing Greece to Afghanistan, comparing Turkey to Iran. What the argument is that this would be worldwide coverage. And how would this court be able to say from a public policy standpoint that we think that this should be worldwide, wherever you go, you're covered? And just tell me how you think they could do that statistically.
Thank you, Justice Wilcox. Let me respond in a couple ways. One, to the initial question, I believe there is some question concerning the language of the policy. I think that this is principally a public policy issue, and I don't want to stray from that. But if you look at the language of the policy, that language refers to losses, occurrences, and accidents. It really does seem more properly tailored to liability coverage than it does to uninsured motorist coverage if you read the language of the provision upon which they rely. So to that extent, I believe there is a language problem, or at least a language issue. I do believe the larger issue is public policy. And I think that the point is this. First of all, I think that it may not be possible to precisely quantify that risk, as it's not possible to precisely quantify many risks. I think, however, it is also true that that same argument could be made in terms of every single provision that's been struck down, and perhaps made more strongly. We have this Astro case where we have the antique automobile policy with 29 automobiles, and this court said, I believe quite properly, this must be personal and portable. It must place the insured in the same position as if the uninsured motorist were insured. And the fact that there was an effort by the company in that case to restrict their loss, and in fact, the premium paid for the policy reflected that effort, did not alter the public policy concerns and the strong thrust of public policy in support of uninsured motorists. So, and the same would be true of the owned uninsured vehicle exclusion cases and the reducing clause cases, the stacking cases. Those cases, I think, clearly imposed a much larger risk on the company, a much larger risk than any extension of uninsured motorist coverage to foreign soil could ever pose, and yet this court did not hesitate to strike those down as violative of the public policy which supports the extension of uninsured motorist coverage in this state.
Yeah, well, taking at random, we don't know the risk, and no one knows the risk that how many people are traveling, how many people from a particular insurance company are traveling outside of the country. Those are the things that I find difficult to answer unless we do it. Just say, well, that's it. You bought insurance and you can't write that in.
And I think that my point, I guess, is that we have said that with respect to a number of risks which are much more significant risks than this, Justice. But the other point I would make is that I do not believe it would be impossible at all to collect statistics on accidents which occur in other countries. Companies basically set rates based on their loss data, on losses that are reported to them. They've got that data. They can certainly collect that on losses in other countries just as they can collect it on losses here. So no, I don't believe it is impossible. I certainly concede that the information may not be quite as readily available, but basically it's information they're driving from their own insurance, and I think it is accessible to them if they need to do that.
Counsel, do you know if under homeowner's insurance that territorial provision is a standard provision? I'm thinking that it's much more likely, for instance, in some countries to lose property by travel in and of itself. If you're like me, you can pack and unpack and lose property easily. But above and beyond that, in terms of high incidence of crime or lawlessness in some areas, is this a common provision in homeowners if I would lose some of my property that normally would be covered under homeowners?
It's a wonderful question. I wish I had a wonderful answer. I don't know, Justice. My sense is that it's not, but that, frankly, is due to speculation on my part. I don't know what the standard provision is in a homeowner's policy. I think that the other thing about the case law that's very significant is the consistency of the approach. We have a whole series of decisions that runs from Welsh to Zastro, but encompasses the Nicholson decision, the Neiman decision. We have a whole variety of restrictions struck down, wind uninsured vehicle restrictions, regular use restrictions, reducing clauses, in addition, of course, to the stacking provisions. And all of these things have uniformly run afoul of the court's perception of this broad-based coverage, which the court has said is available once you've purchased it in all instances under all circumstances. The cases have also addressed some of the very issues that are raised. I mean, they've talked about the fact that there is, even when the restriction is clear, it doesn't matter that it's clear if it runs afoul of our public policy. You know, the fact that the restriction is clear in several of these cases, there's no question that there was a clear restriction. The Hulsey case stands out as one where the language clearly says, we know there's a clear restriction here, we understand that, but this restriction is simply not enforceable. And we believe the same should be true with respect to this restriction. I think it is very significant concerning the consistency of the language and where that language in this line of decisions points us, that defense has been unable to point to a single decision in support of its position that you ought to uphold this particular limitation. They also really offered no persuasive rationale as to why this limitation on coverage should be treated differently than the other limitations which have not been upheld. There is nothing that sets this apart that makes it, as counsel suggested, unique. There's nothing unique about this. In fact, as I pointed out, the risk on a number of these other matters was much greater to the companies than the risk is here collectively. I think the language in the statutory provisions is significant. 344.33 specifically allows, 632.32 does not. The 95 amendment, which counsel spoke of, if anything, I think favors our position. First of all, we need to be clear that this is a 91 case, and obviously the 95 amendment really has no bearing in terms of the court's judgment on this case. We have not argued to the court that there is some sort of trend that the court ought to follow. What we're arguing is simple precedent, what we all live by. We're arguing that the precedents here are clear and they're consistent and the language is strong and compelling, and that this court ought to follow those clear precedents in this particular case. But if we look at the 95 amendment, what we find is that while the court did in fact rule out not just the reducing clause, as counsel suggested, but actually the owned uninsured vehicle provision and also stacking, it dealt specifically with those issues. It said the policy may restrict the coverage in those respects. It did not say that the policy may restrict territorially. That was not put in. That did not match what was done with 344.33. And it's also true that the 95 Amendment does not strike down the personal and portable nature. It certainly makes inroads in it. But the legislature, had it seen fit, could certainly have said, look, we want to revisit this whole issue and we're going to treat this differently. And they did not do that. They made certain specific judgments about restrictions, but did not go beyond that. The argument that's made by counsel with respect to risk is that this is a rational restriction. So are the other restrictions that have been struck down. They're very rational, probably much more rational than this one in terms of the owned uninsured vehicle exclusion. But again, that does not save a restriction when it runs afoul of the fundamental nature of this coverage, which this court has enunciated repeatedly and consistently.
those cases, you don't have to give me the cites.
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, Halsey, there are a series of cases. The Welch decision, would you like to pull the cite? The cite, she's okay, Welch, Halsey, St. Paul versus Zastro, Nicholson versus Home Insurance, Neiman versus Badger Mutual, Carrington versus St. Paul, Parks v. Waffle, and it's Welch versus State Farm, Your Honor. Justice.
These have broad statements about uninsured motorists being important for protection of citizens of Wisconsin, that kind of thing.
I think that if I can just very briefly just read a couple things from Halsey, because I believe they're significant. Halsey says, once uninsured motorist coverage is purchased, the insured
Can you say a little slower?
I'm sorry, Justice. That's a consistent failing, speaking of consistency. Once uninsured motorist coverage is purchased, the insured and his or her relatives insured for liability have uninsured motorist protection under all circumstances. It is prohibited practice in Wisconsin for an insurer to deny by policy limitation the personal and portable nature of the indemnity insurance known as uninsured motorist protection. It went on to say that this, while that very restriction in this clause, which was essentially the owned uninsured vehicle exclusion, had been upheld in liability coverage, it could not be upheld in the case of liability coverage. The provision in her father's policy that denies her coverage as a relative driving her own car as a matter of public policy may only be applied to insurance provisions in the father's insurance contract that lie outside of the uninsured motorist protection. And that's certainly strong language, but frankly quite typical language. And it's mirrored in the Zastro case, which is, I guess, the most recent in this series, which is a 92 case, which says Zastro correctly asserts that this court has characterized uninsured motorist coverage in the standard comprehensive automobile insurance policy as personal and portable coverage, which protects the insured from uninsured motorists in all instances.
Counsel, none of these cases, as I recall, of course, involved this issue. These were all cases between situations that arose within the confines of the United States.
They certainly did, Justice, no question.
Now, here, if we were to hold as you want us to, it seems to me that the burden on the insurance industry then, in attempting to set rates, would be necessary, essentially, to find out what the
problems are, what the uninsured motorist problems are or accidents in every country in the world. Because we can't just limit our holding to Greece. That seems like a formidable burden to put on the industry. Well, not only China and Greece, but some relatively little-known country off the coast of Africa.
Yeah, I think what we're dealing with is two things, Justice. First of all, what you really are collecting is loss data, and from the company to collect that is not difficult. They get loss reports from their insurance, and you make judgments about your loss exposure. I think the other thing that is critical is this is not a coverage which has a large exposure. It's not a large cost coverage, as is evident from the premiums that are talked about in a couple of the cases.
But that might be because they limit it only to the United States.
Well, I think that if we, that could be the argument, but I think that if you look at the character of the other sorts of coverages that have been struck down, certainly stacking carried a much greater burden to the company. Certainly the owned uninsured vehicle exclusion is there's a much more greater likelihood of risk there for the company.
But now with stacking, for instance, they are able to actuarially set a premium because they now know what the rule is and whatever, don't ask me what the rule is on stacking, but they know what the rule is and therefore they can anticipate it. But this, it seems to me, would be next to impossible to anticipate.
I don't think that gathering data on this in terms of loss data, which is what we're talking about, people reporting losses to them, is any more burdensome than gathering loss data on anything else. People come to them, they make claims, they say this is our loss and this is where it occurred. I think that what you're dealing with, Justice, is if you're saying can we micromanage and know what the specific risk is in every country of the world, no, probably not. Can the insurance industry, though, fathom what the risk is and set an appropriate rate to increase that risk? Sure, they've done it with every other kind of risk. They certainly do it with this risk. And I don't think it's unduly burdensome because they don't have to go to all these countries and collect data. All they have to do is collect the information from their insurance when they come to them with a loss. So I don't believe
that. But would that necessarily reflect the true experience? I mean, I've had accidents in other countries. I haven't had accidents, but I've driven in a lot of foreign countries. And I just assume that based upon my policy, I have to get a different insurance because my policy tells me right up front that it's applicable only in Canada and the United States. And so, although I've not had an accident, I doubt very much whether I would report it to my company if I was involved in an accident with an uninsured motorist.
But that's where you set rates. I mean, if they're required to provide the coverage, then they begin collecting the data, and they set the rates based on the data they collect once the coverage is required. So I don't think the question is whether they do it now. The question is, can they do it? And what I'm suggesting is, yes, I don't think that's difficult. They get the information from their insured the way they get any other loss information. So, you know, I don't believe that's unduly burdensome or would change things. And I also think that, you know, we need to look at the character risk. If you're talking about liability risk and you're looking abroad, there you're talking about a risk where, you know, you're concerned about foreign laws, you're concerned about the vagaries of foreign courts. That is not the case here. We're dealing with our courts, we're dealing with our laws, we're dealing with their insured. And I think the nature of that risk is far different than the nature of the risk would be if they were required to provide liability insurance.
Is that the case? If this case were to go to court, could it be venued in Greece? I don't believe so,
Justice, because it's a contract case on a contract that was issued here with a Wisconsin insured and a Wisconsin company.
But the accident occurred there.
It did occur there, but I don't know. I think that under contract law, you'd have to venue it here. I think they'd have every right to venue it here, and clearly everybody's interests are served by venuing it here, and it is where it was venued, obviously, in this particular case. So I think that I understand the concern about that, but I think we also have to go back and look at the language that's used in Halsey, that's used in Zastrow, to use throughout this, because the same concerns that are being reflected were reflected in all those cases. The company says, gee, we tried to limit our risk. This isn't fair. We need this limit. We can't do this. We'll have to pay too much money. And in each one of those cases, we've said, the courts have said, you have said, you cannot do that with this particular coverage. And there is no compelling reason to set this restriction apart and treat it differently than other restrictions.
If I'm driving my car in Nebraska and I get struck by an uninsured motorist, are you telling me that I am forced, because I signed that contract here in Wisconsin, to try the case in Wisconsin?
I think you probably would be, Justice, based on my understanding of the law. I think that we've got a Wisconsin contract and Wisconsin insurance. I think our grouping of contacts law would basically say, yes, that case has to be brought here, not in Nebraska, because this is essentially where the most significant contacts are. That is my understanding of the law, and I believe that's correct.
Are we in the case pending that raises issue?
Is that an amicus?
So if I simplified it somehow, Justice? No, undoubtedly not. Let me turn briefly to the other issue, the issue of the household exclusion. I'm sorry, the membership in the household. There are several things that are significant here, I believe, and I think the law in this case is quite clear. I think that with respect, you know, to the membership in the household, what we're looking at is this. It is clear under our law in a variety of decisions, including the Landre and the Pamperin decisions that were relied on by the defense, that you do not have to be living under the roof. It was said very specifically in those decisions. What those decisions have also said is that the length of absence from the household is also immaterial, except as it may bear on somebody's intent to return. And as Justice Bradley pointed out, that is the critical issue here, was there an intent to return, and was there a continuing nexus with the family that would make it logical to assume that he was going to return and would say, this person is still a member there, he still has connections. What happened here, I think, is important to understand. Bradley had always throughout college and the time he was in Greece maintained most of his property in the home. He had moved back home before leaving for Greece, had all of his goods except a knapsack and a duffel bag that he'd taken with him were left at the home and were in the home. His whole furniture was there. He planned to return to the home upon his completing the time in Greece. His family bought him a two-way ticket to Greece. He, in fact, in Greece lived with, two-way ticket to Spain. He had lived in Spain for a period of time, and had lived in several different places, but at the time this occurred, he was traveling in Europe before coming back to the United States. No one has disputed at any point that it was his intent to return to the household, and I think that was clearly the case. There's some argument made about the length of that commitment. There's nothing in our case law that suggests there's some absolute minimum time. What the Papparin case says is that where you have a stay of very short duration with a definite termination period, which was no more than 30 days in that case, that is not sufficient to make your membership of the household a member of that household, although it's also important to know that in Papparin, what we had was a girl who was still living in her mother's household, who essentially had moved temporarily to her uncle's household to take care of him and was actually going back and staying at her mother's household on occasion. It was certainly not a situation comparable to the one that we have in Clark. What we have in Clark is a young man who had continued his connections with the home, whose license was there, whose mail came there, whose banking accounts were there, whose father, during the time he was in Europe, continued to do his banking for him, a young man who undisputedly was returning to that home as soon as he completed his travels through Europe, and who planned to stay there, as he testified, for not less than 3 months and probably significantly longer than that. He could not enroll in school for the fall semester. It was too late. And there is no question, I think, that he was going to return home, and that was his intent. In fact, after this accident, he did return home and remained there for years. He was still living at home, as we point out, at the time that this case was tried. I think all of those factors speak strongly to the fact that it was his intent to return home, that he had always retained a substantial connection with the home and still did. We've had cites to foreign law, actually, on both of these issues, and I would simply point out that with respect to the foreign cases cited on the UM issue, which we discussed earlier, the territorial restriction, those cases do not arise under the same public policy that we have in this state. Our public policy is critical here. It's pivotal to this determination, and it's been stated and restated clearly and strongly and consistently. And there is not a single case that counsel has cited where he points out the same public policy was considered in reaching the decision that they reached. So I think to look at other decisions in that issue is not helpful. I believe the same thing is essentially true here, although I think there's probably even less reason to do so in one sense, and that is that we have clear law. We've got the Giese versus Karstadt case, as well as the other cases we've cited, which on the facts before this court, you know, would say strongly that Brad Clark did have a continuing connection with the home and had every right to be considered a member of the family. He even was actually still part of the policy. There had been some insurance claim made just before he left. He was still part of the umbrella policy. Every indicator that we would look at would suggest to us that there was a strong continuing connection with the family home, an intent to return there, and a likelihood that he would remain there for a substantial period of time.
Mr. Riley, you just mentioned the umbrella policy. Would you tell us why you feel that there should not be a reduction that would credit to American Family the $60,000 paid under the umbrella policy?
Yes, Justice Crooks, thank you. I believe what's significant there is this, is that the argument that's made by counsel for the defense is that this is similar insurance, and they're relying on their other insurance clause. What we have said, and I believe what the Old Haven case says quite clearly, is that this is not similar insurance. This is an entirely different kind of insurance, which is an umbrella policy. In fact, in this particular case, there's no question that the policy that was written by Cincinnati as an umbrella policy is specifically written over the basic coverages, which are the American Family coverages. I mean, those are the basic coverages over which the umbrella provides protection. Until we reached the $750,000, which was the aggregate coverage available under American Family, Cincinnati had no exposure at all. And to suggest, as they have, that we ought to prorate this coverage or give them credit for that settlement really makes no sense at all. Cincinnati would have had no exposure had this case been tried as it develops, because we did not reach the $750,000. If we do what counsel suggests we do, we essentially would undermine the entire system of umbrella coverage, because what we would do is say to the umbrella carriers, no, you don't just have an excess exposure, which obviously is the basis for their rating and the reason that they're able to charge a relatively modest premium for these policies. You're now going to be pro rata, and you're going to be in a worst-case situation, because generally umbrella policies are larger, and so not only are you pro rata, but we're going to, you know, you're going to have your $1 million prorated against the smaller amount underneath, and instead of paying nothing on a claim that's within the underlying coverage, you're actually going to pay the lion's share of the claim within the underlying coverage. That's simply antithetical to the entire purpose and concept of umbrella liability policies, Justice, and that's why I believe that it would not be appropriate to grant a credit in this case.
And the American Family policy has a reducing clause that talks about similar insurance, is that right?
Yes, it does. It has an other insurance clause, Justice. It's the same basic purpose, right? And it does refer to other similar insurance.
I guess my question on the umbrella would only be, I'm just thinking this, as you were speaking, that if you read the policy, I'm talking about American Family policy, and you saw there was a territorial restriction, meaning that it was only available in United States and Canada, then the assumption would be that the umbrella policy was based upon, you know, they read the policy too and they knew what their risks were. So I was just thinking whether that would make any difference, whether we read in or read out the territorial restriction, you know, as far as coverage. Because the risk, as I'm saying, for umbrella companies would be known, and they would, until this court makes a decision, would be assuming that perhaps we would go with the restriction, or they would not consider that it would be not good public policy. They would never consider that, right, as far as whether or not they would take coverage. You know, umbrella is based on, you said you had underlying, you knew that American Family had insurance. But here we have a little different situation where we're considering a UM coverage and whether or not the territorial restriction would cover. So I'm just talking about the underlying, you were talking about the risks and whether or not they would accept that.
I would think that any insurance company that's not aware of the strong pronouncements on public policy in this area hasn't done their homework. I mean, this has certainly been clear law in this state for a number of years, and it's been repeated. I think that the key is here that we really are looking at. I mean, they're relying on a provision that says other similar insurance. I don't believe that even in a common sense, you know, ordinary man's situation, most folks would look at an umbrella policy as similar insurance to underlying automobile liability policies. It's just not. Their argument is that you ought to look at the fact that it's both under uninsured motorist coverage. Actually, the Cincinnati policy did not, by its terms, provide uninsured motorist coverage, although the court determined that it should be required to, at least as far as the coverage trial went. But I do think they're just very different coverages with very different considerations and very different premium structures, and I think that is significant. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Riley.
If I may go back to the coverage question. The line of cases that you cited when I asked Welch, Halsey, Sastro, etc., you raised that in your brief, and I was just reading again the reply brief as to how they distinguish those cases. And they said that you are using those cases improperly. That essentially that Welch and its progeny were all overruled, as we had invited the legislature, were overruled by the statutes, and they were stacking cases or other car exclusions, and therefore really are no longer applicable to this case. Since you didn't have an opportunity to file a reply brief to his reply brief, how do you answer their footnotes 3 and 4?
Okay. I think the answer is this, Justice. First of all, this is a 91 case. I mean, this case is governed by the laws that existed in 1991, not by what the legislature did in 1995. So like, that's the simplest answer. That really has no bearing on this case whatsoever. We don't have to rely on the 95 law, nor is he entitled to rely on the 1995 law. I note that the 1995 law did not incorporate this restriction, although it did incorporate a number of others. But I think you can certainly argue from that the legislature did not see fit to impose this sort of restriction, although they had the opportunity to do so. I think what's perhaps more important is that just as this court invited them to do in Zastro, invited them to do things, they've had an opportunity to do this. If they want to do this, and if there is the concern that you've raised concerning potential exposure, if the companies really find this such a burdensome potential exposure, then the answer is simple. They go to the legislature, and Halsey says that's the appropriate step to take. I believe that Zastro does, and certainly Welsh, and certainly Parks does. May I continue?
Yes.
Thank you. Certainly Parks does. They have the opportunity to do that. I do not believe this poses a significant problem, but if it does, the answer, as these cases say, is simple. Then you go to the legislature and ask them to act. But in the absence of legislative action, the clear public policy of this state that's been enunciated and repeated and has been absolutely consistent through these cases should be enforced with respect to this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Riley. Mr. Klinner, you have a few moments for rebuttal.
Thank you. Briefly, we are not asking this court to repudiate every statement it has ever made regarding the broad scope of UM coverage. What we are asking the court to do is to consider whether the Territorial Restriction Clause, which has certain unique concerns that reducing clauses do not implicate, should be enforced.
Could you speak up, counsel? I'm having a terribly difficult time hearing you.
Sure. I'm simply saying that this court is not being asked to repudiate everything it's ever said about the broad scope of UM coverage.
Let me ask this question. Umbrella coverage doesn't have territorial exclusions. If there's no underlying coverage, then the umbrella coverage arguably could apply in other countries, in the middle of any continent that we want to pick. My concern in part is how does the insurance company get the information for UM coverage? How do they calculate their risk to assess their premium? I guess I would ask the same question with regard to the umbrella coverage. I mean, the umbrella coverage arguably covers uninsured motorist claims on Greek islands. How do you think they calculate for that premium?
Well, I think that they are effectively in the same position as American Family would be in terms of obtaining the information and in terms of basically just guessing. I don't think that it's possible to gather sufficient reliable information on every country in the world. We can't just focus on Greece per se. But
it seems to minimize the concern then, because for me, because if the umbrella coverage is available all over the world for UM claims, why not UM coverage?
Well, I would think that umbrella policies, if the companies chose to do so, could include territorial restrictions or could limit themselves to coverage where the underlying policy has coverage.
You don't know on what basis Cincinnati...